Welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. I'm Susan Wall, and I'm reading August Gale by Maine author Barbara Walsh. Copyright 2012 by Barbara Walsh, and published by GPP in Guilford, Connecticut. Today we're beginning episode 11 on page 146 of this 247-page book. In episode 10, Tom Reed and young Frankie, alone aboard the Annie Anita, began to despair as midnight neared and the storm worsened. Captain Patty and Jerome were out on dories and appeared less and less likely to make it back to the ship. Tom and Frankie huddled together in a cabin below decks and prayed. 50 miles away, another schooner survived the night, but in the early morning witnessed the final rolling and capsizing of the Mary Bernice, her crew all doomed. In 2003, Barbara interviews 85-year-old Pad Kelly. He fished on a dory at age 17 and survived the August gale, and now remembers the fear, the ferocity of the storm, and the losses. Back in 1935, at the end of the episode, Father McGettigan prayed through the night, as did all the residents of Marystown. Now, episode 11. On Reed Hill, Shoal Point, in Marystown, Fox Cove, and Little Bay, families gathered beneath the lamplight. The Reeds, Mitchells, Hanrahans, Farrells, Clarks, Walshes, Longs, and Brintons knelt on kitchen and bedroom floors. "Pray for your poor Da," their mothers urged. "Pray to the Lord to save his soul." Ernestine Walsh winced at the thunderclap and the lightning flash that lit up the kitchen. The girl of 9 closed her eyes, praying for the noises to cease, for the wind to calm, and for the bad things to stop. Rain pounded their roof and leaked in torrents onto the kitchen floor. Gusts off the bay had blown out their kitchen window, sending shards of glass flying across the room. They had all screamed in the middle of their prayers at the sudden crash. Mother had nailed a quilt over the jagged opening, but the wind still found its way inside, shrieking like a wounded animal. The remaining kitchen window rattled, and Ernestine searched out the glass pane, looking for her father Ernest's schooner. Like her Uncle Paddy, her Da had set sail a week before the storm. "Please come home, Da. Don't let the gale take you." Ernestine worried, too, for her cousins, Frankie, Jerome, and James, and of course for Uncle Paddy. Out of father's 5 brothers, Paddy was her favorite. He could be a devil, drinking and carrying on, but he always looked after her and her family when Da was away. If one of them fell ill, Uncle Paddy was there to make sure they had enough food, enough medicine, and wood for the fire. Out on the bay, small globes of light caught the girl's eye. Ernestine spied 2 schooners sailing through the whitecaps. Lights fastened to the rigging, illuminating the boat's bow and stern. Ernestine shouted, recognizing the vessels. "Mom, Uncle Paddy's back, and there's James behind him!" The schooners veered to the north side of Marystown, near the presbytery. "Why are they on the north side, Mother? Why aren't they coming up to the southern shore by Uncle Paddy's wharf?" Her mother shook her head and did not speak. Ernestine turned back to the window for another look at the vessels, but the boats were gone. Beyond Reed Hill, farther east in Little Bay, Richard Hanrahan's small home shuddered against the wind gusts. Bride Hanrahan hid beneath her bed covers as the sky crackled and lightning burst like balls of fire. From the kitchen, Bride could hear her mother sobbing as she murmured the rosary. Earlier in the night, Bride and her 4 siblings had knelt by their mother's chair, chanting Hail Marys for their father. When the clock tolled 2 in the morning, their mother had put them to bed, urging them to rest. But Bride feared sleep and her dreams. When she dozed, the images came to her. She saw her father thrashing in the sea. His mouth was open in a scream, but the roar of the wind silenced his cries. Weighted down with his oilskins, the waves crashed over his head, dragging him under. And then there was nothing but walls of black water, cresting, crashing. In the foaming sea, a flash of yellow appeared, her father's jacket sleeve. He shouted her name. His hand reached for her, for anything to hold on to. Hollering against the wind, she shouted to him, "Here, Da, I'm here!" Her small hand searched for her father's palm, but his body had vanished. There was only the sea, the mad, wild sea. She could hear his cries no more. Lucy Walsh stifled her own screams as labor pains tore through her abdomen. It seemed the storm had brought on the young woman's contractions, and now at the height of the gale, her pains grew more rapid, more fierce. Selina Galton held her daughter's hand, trying to calm the soon-to-be mother. A midwife, Galton had delivered hundreds of babies in Little Bay, Marystown, and the surrounding outports. But this birth would bring its own complications. The thunder, lightning, and roaring wind had whipped Lucy into a fit of hysteria. She was beside herself with worry for her husband, James. "He'll never see the baby now! Never!" she cried. "Hush now. James and his crew will be fine," Galton told her daughter, though the older woman did not believe the fisherman stood a chance. She had never seen a storm this vicious in all her years. Galton could only imagine the horror James and his crew faced at sea. "You've got to focus on your baby now, my dear," Galton told her. "Your child will be here soon." Overhead, the rafters groaned, and Galton prayed the roof would hold. "Lord, spare us from difficulties with this birth tonight. The doctor would never make it across the bay in conditions this rough." Sterilizing cloths for the birth, Galton uttered more prayers. As she headed back upstairs to her daughter's bedroom, she struggled to return to Lucy's side. Invisible forces, shapes, stood in front of her, spirits who wanted to be present, to witness the birth of Lucy's child. Galton made the sign of the cross over her forehead, fearing James and his crew had passed on. "Dear God, James is just a young man, and his wife barely turned 20 herself, married only 3 months they were. Lucy's heart would surely break in two if he never returned." The midwife pushed the dark thoughts from her mind and focused on her daughter and the baby that was coming fast. "Push, Lucy, you're close now." Pink and robust, the child emerged without complications and oblivious to the gale that roared outside. "It's a girl," Galton announced, handing the infant to her daughter. The child, Lucy quickly decided, would be named Jamie after her father. Swaddled and searching for her mother's milk, the infant wailed, and Galton sensed a presence behind her. She turned to the sea chest that rested by her daughter's bed. There sat James, a vision in the dark. The midwife gasped at the sight, and then the realization struck. "My dear Lucy, you've become a mother and a widow on the same eve. Your husband is gone now, girl. May the Lord watch over ye and your new babe." The shock of it, Galton knew, would not leave Lucy for a good long while. She only hoped that her daughter would not look upon little Jamie as a reminder of death and loss. Across the bay, Father McGettigan tried to settle himself beneath layers of quilts and blankets. Though he had finished several glasses of rum this evening, the liquor offered little solace. Concern for Paddy, James, and their crews gnawed at his every thought. Cursing the wind that continued to shriek like a banshee, the priest blew the flame from the kerosene lamp and recited another prayer. "Mary, Mother of God, guide them through the dark and roaring sea. Offer them your blessings, your benevolence, and your protection. Amen." From the third-floor attic, he could hear the maid, the young girl, Lizzie, shifting in her bed. "Sleep will not come for any of us tonight," the priest thought. Moments later, McGettigan heard an odd pounding. The knocking continued and grew louder before he realized someone was at the door. Who could be out at such an hour on such a wretched night? Relighting the lamp, McGettigan made his way downstairs and opened the presbytery door. There on the stoop stood Paddy and his crew. Dressed in their oilskins, the men remained silent, solemn, before the priest could speak. Before he could embrace Paddy and praise the Lord for a miracle, the fisherman disappeared, leaving McGettigan alone in the blinding rain. "What is it, sir?" Lizzie asked from the stairs. McGettigan turned to her, his face white as chalk. "They're gone. They're all gone. We'll never see nor hear of them again." Chapter 20. My poor daddy was lost. Marystown, 2003. We travel east, Following the course Patty last sailed on that August morning when skies were clear, the wind calm. The sky on this June afternoon is also cloudless, a brilliant blue. As our car crests Reed Hill, we glimpse views of the water below, vistas where children and wives long looked for a familiar sail, a returning vessel. Here from the southern shores of Marystown, the children of the gale waited and watched, praying that their fathers would survive the storm. I imagine the strange happenings that night, the terrifying sounds, the unexplained omens. Ernestine Walsh, her face pressed to the window pane, her eyes wide, envisioning Patty and James returning in their schooners, kerosene lights guiding the phantom boats through a tempest of roaring wind and lashing rain. The baby, Jamie, a wailing infant born amidst a howling gale as her father's spirit stirred in the room. Bride Hanrahan's dream, the images of her dad, his frantic hand reaching for her as he disappeared beneath the angry sea. Of the dozens of children who prayed that night, 42 would never see their fathers again. Some would remember their last farewell, their father's kiss, the touch of his calloused hand. Others would hold on to the image of their dad's broad backs, sea bags slung over shoulders, dories drifting away in the dark. I imagine my father's memories of Ambrose vanishing, disappearing in the night. On the dark streets of Brooklyn, Ambrose closes a door, softly stepping into the cold November air, and in the morning a boy of 11 learns, "Your father's gone." Like the children of the gale, my father carries memories. How he was never far from Ambrose's side, following him to the Staten Island playgrounds and to the ship-rigging lofts of Brooklyn. How Ambrose's strong hands wrestled him to the living-room floor or braced his wobbling bicycle. How the two of them took car rides alone, father and son, Ambrose at the wheel, and his boy Ronnie standing on the seat beside him, his small arm wrapped securely around the shoulder of a man who kept him safe, held him close. How many times did my father wish for Ambrose's return, pray that his family would be whole again? How many times did he wonder, why did my father leave us? For decades, the children of the gale have asked those same questions. Despite the passing of 68 years, their sorrow lingers. On this June afternoon, we seek the gale children, men and women who are now in their 70s and 80s and live in Marystown or nearby. Patty's niece, Gertrude Walsh, has agreed to share her stories with us. The eldest daughter of Ernest Walsh's 7 children, Gertrude was 14 in 1935. With a few hastily scratched directions to her house, my father, Joni, and I venture east along Marine Drive, the road that leads from Marystown to Little Bay and the sea. There are a few markers in the small village of 160 people, and naturally we get lost, several times. Short on patience, my father utters a "Jesus Christ, where the hell is this place?" moments before we find Gertrude's driveway. 82-year-old Gertrude and her daughter invite us into their kitchen. Gertrude sits in her rocking chair and leans forward to hear our conversation. Her daughter has warned us that her mother tires easily and may have difficulty talking with us, but when Gertrude speaks, her voice is strong and clear. She has no trouble recalling the storm and shakes her head at the memory of that August night. "Gales, gales, gales," she says, closing her eyes. "The wind howled. Oh, it was awful. Mother lit the candles as the wind came through the windows. It was a terrible night. We gathered by Mother's feet and said the rosary with her. We prayed for Father, and we prayed for Uncle Patty. The rain and the wind lashed down, and the water poured in through the roof. We never had a leak like that before." Like many of the fishermen's children, Gertrude dreamt of her dad. In her mind, she saw his hand on the helm of the J.R. Rogers, his back bent to the wind as he sailed into the harbor. "I dreamt my daddy came in and anchored his boat, but when we got up the next morning, he wasn't there. Uncle Patty hadn't returned either. We were worried sick for them both." "Can you tell us some stories about Patty?" I ask. My request stirs a grin and a glimpse of a girl who admired her uncle's rambunctious nature. As with her memory of the gale, her stories of Uncle Patty are vivid. Crossing 2 fingers, she presses them to her chest and explains, "My dad and Uncle Patty were just like that, close as could be. Uncle Patty was my favorite. Oh, he was a character. I loved him." He was a good man, but tough, the worst of all the brothers. He could argue about anything. But when he was fighting, all you had to do was put your arms around him and say, "Uncle Paddy, be quiet now." Paddy, Gertrude tells us, enjoyed music and song, but he could not carry a note. I think I was his favorite because I used to sing dirty songs for him. He'd give me a quarter when I was done. "Go get candy," he'd say. "After the gale," she says, her voice dropping to a whisper, "I never sang those songs again." Gertrude closes her eyes, and her daughter nods to us, worried that her mother has worn herself out. Thanking her for her memories, I reach for Gertrude and hug her goodbye. We let ourselves out the door, and I wonder if Gertrude has any stories of my grandfather. Over the past few days, at kitchen tables, on living room sofas, and even in the local funeral parlor, where we stopped to pay our respects to Winnie Walsh, Ambrose's sister-in-law, we have heard several tales about Ambrose. His nieces, nephews, and old neighbors spoke about his charm, his ability to talk easily and convincingly at length on any subject, his knack for putting people at ease within minutes of meeting them. "Your dad was a good man," these relatives told my father. "Everyone loved Ambrose. He had a great personality." Sometimes my dad did not reply. Other times he shared his ill feelings, the memories that still haunt. "He deserted us," he explained. "I don't hate him, but I cannot forgive him for what he did to my mother." Not fond of sympathy, my father also wants his relatives to know he has lived a good life, that his dreams of owning his own home, raising a family, have been fulfilled. "I am the luckiest guy in the world," he explains. "I have 6 beautiful daughters and a wonderful wife." My father smiled beneath his navy baseball cap when he spoke those words, and though I knew, he truly believed that he is the luckiest man in the world, a sentiment he had shared numerous times when offering a toast at birthday, Christmas, and anniversary celebrations. I also understood these conversations with his Newfoundland family were not easy. In his heart, my father cannot call Ambrose a good man. He cannot forget the past. He cannot erase what happened in Brooklyn or San Francisco. "It's like they want me to forgive him or something," he tells Joni and me in the car after one encounter. "They sure seemed to like him. They all thought he was wonderful." As we drive along the quiet and curvy roads from Gertrude's little bay home back to Marystown, I replay the comments about Ambrose in my mind. Are our relatives saying kind words about my grandfather to make us feel welcomed? Like my father's half-sisters, Donnie and Kathy, our Newfoundland kin saw the good in my grandfather. He was well-loved, well-liked. Would I have liked him? Would I have found him charming, enjoyed his stories? Would I have forgiven him for deserting my dad? Winding past the cluster of houses along Reed Hill, we look for the home of Michael Farrell, whose father crewed for James Walsh on the Mary Bernice. A short distance from Paddy's home, we spot the small white house that sits along the bay. A bachelor who lives alone, Farrell has been waiting for our arrival. A thin, dark-haired man, he welcomes us from his doorstep. "God bless ye! Come in!" he hollers. Cats, nearly a dozen of them, roam the yard. A few scurry inside the house. Not fond of felines, Joni heads back to the car, explaining that she will pick us up later. My father and I follow Farrell inside where he pulls kitchen chairs out for us. In the dimly lit room, Farrell begins to talk. The words tumble from his mouth quickly. He is excited to share his stories, but his Newfoundland accent is thick, almost incomprehensible. I glance at my father's eyes, and I know he is thinking, "Oh, brother." Still, Farrell has something to say, and we want to understand him. Our conversation evolves into an odd charade. Farrell speaks a few sentences, and my father and I try to select words that we recognize and repeat them back. This goes on for 10 minutes, before we figure out that Farrell was a year old at the time of the storm. He had 3 older siblings, and his mother's name was Victoria. Farrell begins to talk about the night of the gale, and my father and I lean forward. "The wind," Farrell tells us, repeating the word again, before we have the chance to do so. "The wind was fierce that night. My gosh, the old people thought the roof was going to blow off." Farrell says something about his mother, explaining that she saw a token. "Token?" My father and I ask, unfamiliar with this word, that we will later learn means a vision, a portent of death. Ignoring our question, Farrell continues his story, and we discern the words hallway and boots. We utter the words back to him, and Farrell patiently tells us the story again, this time slowly. The night of the gale, his mother heard noises in her second-floor hallway. "Me mother could hear someone walking in the hall," he tells us. "She got up from her bed and saw me father in his oilskins and boots. He was walking back and forth in the hall." "Your mother saw his spirit?" I ask. Farrell nods. "She kept shouting his name, but he would not answer. He just kept pacing the floorboards. She knew then my poor daddy was lost." Barely a toddler at the time of the gale, Farrell has no memory of the father he was named after. He cannot recall his father's voice, his face, his dad's large calloused hands. "All I knew when I was a boy was that my poor daddy was lost, drowned, gone forever. I used to feel terrible about it. I wished I knew what happened, how he went." Farrell falls silent, and my father and I are quiet, too. From the window, I see Joni pull into the driveway. Knowing we have garnered as much as possible from Farrell, I stand, telling him, "Thanks for talking with us. I am sorry about your father." He shakes our hands, appreciative that we listened to his stories. As we head out the door, he bids us another, "God bless ye." I smile at Farrell and return his blessing. My father, who, like Joni, is not fond of cats, walks quickly to the car. Farrell continues to wave goodbye, and I sense his sadness, a son lonely for his father. 68 years after the gale, his sorrow lingers. His words echo in my head. "All I knew was that me poor daddy was lost." I follow my father's footsteps, taking in the sight of his back, the broad shoulders that have carried his own loss for much of his life. As he slips into the passenger seat, I wonder which is worse. To have no memories of your dad before he vanishes in a roiling sea, or to be deserted on a cold November night by a father who was your hero, your idol for the first 11 years of your life. Chapter 21. Shipwrecked Schooners and Bodies Swallowed by the Sea. Newfoundland, 1935. Swamped with water and stripped of her masts, the schooner drifted off Cape Pine. From the shore, fishermen watched the forsaken vessel pitch and roll. As the waves continued to pound the schooner, she struggled to stay afloat. There would be no survivors, the men knew. The crew was most certainly drowned, victims of a gale that showed no mercy and heard no prayers. "Yes, boy, 'tis certain to be all hands lost," a gray-haired dory man murmured. "There be many that won't come home from this dirty weather. No, the sea, she'll be keeping plenty of souls, she will." The fishermen nodded and rubbed the religious medals in their pockets, knowing this August gale would be forever remembered and long mourned. There would be stories told, songs penned, and homes where grieving would carry on until widows turned gray and old. In the days following the hurricane, as the winds calmed and the waves grew smaller, the counting of the dead and missing began. It seemed no vessel, big or small, had escaped the hurricane's wrath. The schooner floating off Cape Pine was but one of several derelicts that littered the sea. The phantom boats drifted, devoid of life, their decks robbed of dories, masts, sails, and spars. Scores of other schooners were reported missing or wrecked, smashed to pieces on sunkers and jagged cliffs. Hatch covers, spars, and planks from broken-up vessels washed ashore or floated on the sea. Captains and crew who returned spoke of a gale fiercer than anything their eyes had ever seen. "'Tis like the divil rose up from the sea. The water she boiled up and crashed upon us like mountains. The wind she was blowing wicked to the world. 'Twas nothing to do but lash yourself to the rigging or go down below and pray. Yes, boys, 'twas the most vicious gale I've ever been through in all me years. When we got ashore, I never felt so lucky in me life, and a lot of souls, they weren't so lucky. No, they'll never be seen no more." On land and along the coast, the gale wrought thousands of dollars worth of damage. Hundreds of dories, schooners, and motorboats were ripped from their moorings and sunk or smashed. Gale winds of 59 miles an hour, with ferocious gusts, tore telephone poles from the ground, ripped 100-year-old trees from their roots, and blue roofs from houses and barns. The hurricane's violent winds and waves stirred even the dead. The bodies of two fishermen and a young lad drowned several months past rose from the ocean floor. Barely identifiable, their corpses washed up along three different shores, remains that would, to their family's relief, now receive a proper grave, a final place to rest. In small outports and villages, the mourning and prayers would begin anew for sons and fathers, men whose bodies had vanished in the gale, victims whose final fate would remain a secret of the sea. Throughout Newfoundland, constables and parish priests received reports of doomed vessels and lost crews. Schooner Walter L. plunged to the bottom of Trepassey Bay. Captain Butcher, his three brothers, and a fifth crew member suspected washed overboard or gone down with the vessel. LCJ, wrecked in Placentia Bay, Captain John Gallet and crew of five presumed lost with all hands. Annie Young, wrecked on Fox Island, crew of eight feared dead. Norman Wareham, wrecked in Fortune Bay, crew safe ashore. Lizzie E. B., wrecked in Indian Harbor. Eureka, destroyed in Herring Neck. Helen Healy missing, no trace of crew. Wreckage of the Carrie Evelyn picked up, no sign of her five men. Schooner Reginald Ansey, believed lost with all hands. Board bearing the vessel's name picked up at Bay Verte. Phyllis West dashed on the rocks. Crew abandoned vessel and took to their dories. Like dozens of other vessels, the fate of the three Walsh schooners from Marystown and their crews remained uncertain. Annie Anita and its skipper, Paddy Walsh, and crew unaccounted for. Schooner Mary Bernice believed to be floating bottom-up near Virgin Rocks in Placentia Bay. No sign of Captain James Walsh or the other four fishermen. The J.R. Rogers reported missing, no word from Captain Ernest Walsh or his crew. The fortunate schooners that survived the gale limped ashore, battered and barely afloat, their sails torn to ribbons, anchor chains ripped from bows. The Nova Scotia schooner Beatrice Beck arrived in harbor, reporting a crew member swept overboard along with four dories and everything else movable on deck. The Senora Dosandi, a Portuguese schooner sailing from Greenland to Newfoundland, shared a similar tale. A giant comber plucked one of its dorymen into the sea and critically injured two others. Newspapers in London, New York, and the Maritime Provinces chronicled the death and destruction. Newfoundland coast lashed by fierce storm. August gale kills more than 40 Newfoundland fishermen. Feared loss of life may exceed 50. On August 26, the day after the gale swept across Newfoundland, the Canadian government dispatched the SS Argyle and SS Malakoff to look for bodies and survivors. Monday evening and Tuesday morning, the steamers searched Placentia, Trepassey, and St. Mary's Bays with little luck. Their only find, a waterlogged dory marked with its schooner's name, the Annie Anita. Later that day, the fishermen of a small village sighted another casualty of the gale. The tides had carried the derelict schooner from Cape Pine west to Hazel Cove. Standing on the headlands above the inlet, three fishermen from St. Schott's spied the vessel as the waves drove the craft ashore. And with the Annie Anita washing ashore, we'll close episode 11 of August Gale by Barbara Walsh. I'm Susan Wall. Thank you for listening.